I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening in Nova Scotia at Axe Radio Canada, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, on the Co-Creator Network, or you might even be watching this in a slideshow on YouTube at youtube.com/spiritualshow. So today I'm super excited to speak with Dr. Stan Tatkin. But before we bring him up, I just want to let you know also that one of my previous guests, Dr. Shefali Sabri, is going to be on Oprah's show on May 18th for the first time ever. They're doing Super Soul Sunday and Life Class. It's going to be running various times throughout the day on May 18th on OWN, as well as on their website. So wherever you are in the world, you don't have to be a subscriber to that network. You can get it on their website. And so I really wanted to bring that in today because I feel like if you've read Dr. Shefali's book, The Conscious Parent, and her newest book, Out of Control, you might not actually need Dr. Stan Tatkin in the future, or maybe your kids won't. So, but we're going to be speaking with Stan in just a moment. Dr. Stan Tatkin is the founder of the PACT Training Institute and the developer of PACT, which is a psychobiological approach to couple therapy. And PACT is an integration of neuroscience, arousal regulation, and attachment theory. This therapy modality centers on early attachment and its effect on the development of the brain and the nervous system. And also, PACT encourages couples to participate in what's called secure functioning relationships, even if the individuals themselves don't have secure attachment. And Dr. Stan is the author of the book Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship. And he also has an audio program called Your Brain on Love. And I have been reading and listening to both. I would highly, highly recommend both. I feel like if I'd had this information a few years ago, I'd probably already be happily married. So, and then you wouldn't have to hear me complaining about my dating all the time. So how would that be? Anyway, welcome to this show, Dr. Stan.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thanks. How are you?
I'm fine.
Wonderful. Well, first, I want to start things out with reading a quote by the foreword of your book, Wired for Love, was written by Harville Hendricks. And he says, when you make your relationship primary and your needs secondary, you produce the paradoxical effect of getting your needs met in ways they can never be met if you made them primary.
Right.
And that's really what your work is all about. Dr. Stan, can you give us a little bit of background about what brought you to this? You were working with infant brain development, and then something happened and moved you towards couples therapy.
Yeah, I was working with prevention. I wanted to prevent personality disorders. And so I was working with mother-infant pairs and father-infant pairs to do that. And I had a lot of background before that, working in hospital inpatient and so on. So I thought, the couple is sort of the adult version of the infant mother pair with some big differences, of course. And I found at the time that I started to do research in this area that the marital outcome studies of the day were very similar in terms of what predicted a good marriage or a good relationship, very similar to that of what predicted a good secure attachment in an infant-parent relationship. And so I went forward with that and started working with adult romantic relationships.
Awesome. And so there's talk of personal and societal healing, and that's why I wanted to bring up Dr. Shefali's book in the intro, because the attachments that we have and the way we are in our attachment relationships with our parents as well as with our partners really make us who we are out in the world, too. I mean, if we're a hot mess in our relationships, we're not going to be behaving that well out in the world.
Well, generally speaking, and this is, I think, the way many of us in the field think of this, you know, we start off as a duo, as a dyad, a very important dyad. That's the, again, the parent-child relationship. But we also started that way, too, in the beginning as humans developed, you know, in the dyad situation, the two-person system. The same thing for us today. And, you know, we're hurt in relationships, we're healed in relationships. Hot mess is interesting. You know, this is an ongoing process that has to be done in a love relationship or in a surrogate relationship, like a therapeutic one, you know, or some other relationship where some of this stuff is healed. But there's always hope, and hopefully, you know, people don't avoid being in a relationship because they think they're a hot mess. Many of us think we're a hot mess, and we're not really.
Well, that's thank you for that. And actually, you bring this up. I believe it was in your audio program, Your Brain on Love. You say there's right. there's no such thing as a low maintenance person in relationships.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, low maintenance. I mean, there are lower maintenance type people that seem that way. But I think when we get close to someone and we begin to depend on them and them on us, over time, that idea of low maintenance goes away because we all become burdens after a while. You know, this is just the way life goes. We're going to get sick. We're going to get depressed. We're going to lose our jobs. Things are going to happen, and we're no longer that low maintenance person. People look low maintenance from a distance, which is why affairs are so attractive. But get really close to that person, and you'll have a similar problem with them.
Thank you. Well, Dr. Stan, I really want everyone to read and listen to your book and your program so that they can fully understand this, because there's so many intricacies. But let's talk about some of the main points. You talk about having this couple bubble. What is that?
Well, a couple bubble is basically, you know, a sort of a semi-permeable ecosystem. You know, this is the couple's you know, terrarium, so to speak. It's the air they breathe, the water they drink. It's kind of like being in a foxhole together. Is the couple self-protective? Do they, you know, create resources within that system? Do they protect those resources from the outside, from people intruding and trying to take those resources, third things, third people, and so on, tasks, drugs and alcohol, anything like that? And so this really speaks to the idea that these two people have a reason to be together above and beyond attraction, that they love each other, but that they actually do things for each other that nobody else is willing to do. And this then makes them both a burdens, right? You know, you're my burden, I'm your burden. Together, it cancels out. We do things for each other that nobody else really is willing to do. And in that bubble, we are, you know, experts on each other. We have each other's owner's manual. I can honestly say that I'm good at my work, but I'm also good at you, and you can say the same. We're better at each other than anybody else could be because we pay attention. We watch. We're interested, and that interest pays back because we have somebody who's interested in ourselves as well. So this is a self-containing unit that is there to not only survive the slings and arrows of, you know, a life, but also an environment that's not so friendly all the time. We watch each other's back. We protect each other in public and private. We know exactly the right, you know, itch to scratch and where to scratch it. We can do things for each other, like I said, that are golden, irreplaceable. And this comes out of interest. This really, you know, we do it because we can. And it's a different way of framing, you know, the purpose of relationship. And we're sorely needing, I think, now in our culture, a reason to be paired. And in fact, in missing that, I think it's very easy to you know, go the short distance and not the long distance.
Now, Dr. Stan, we live in North America in a really individualistic society, and we're taught... I remember being told in kindergarten that no one would love me unless I love myself. And I can't love anyone else unless I love myself first, literally kindergarten. How is what you teach different than that?
Well, we know that that's not how it works with the human infant or adult. Everything basically we do, we don't do well by ourselves. We do it, because it's been done for us, to us. We learn from the outside in. We don't learn to love ourselves first. It's impossible. We learn to love ourselves through the eyes of another person. And we know this, of course, when we think of babies, but we don't think of this in terms of adult relationships, that my sense of self is constantly being modeled by how you feel about me, how I feel that you feel about me. And, you know, if you and I are fans of each other and we're loving each other properly, this also reflects back in terms of how we love ourselves. So we don't learn to love ourselves in the absence of another person. We do that at the same time. There's no possible way to do that in a cave or through a book or a workshop. You have to do it with another person.
And
does that make sense?
It does, yes. And I'm totally on board with this. I feel like this is what I've been searching for my whole life, and I've actually had people tell me, no, you can't have that. That's too needy.
Yeah, there's certain people who we know are going to say that someone's too needy, and that's usually a person who grew up being ashamed of their own neediness in a family where you don't get to be needy. You're supposed to take care of yourself. Don't depend on anybody. That's embarrassing. And these people, are raised in families where performance is at the top of the priority list, appearance and performance, not dependency and not warm, cuddly, fuzzy stuff. So many times the person who is saying you're too needy themselves is actually incredibly needy. They just don't realize it.
I've actually noticed that, and it's interesting. There's the people who are more aware of how needy they are. Those are the wave people, and the
or regular anchor people
or anchor people. And then there's the islands. Those are the ones that aren't very touchy feely. They are accustomed to taking care of themselves, and they really value that, and they feel that they're really independent.
But their dependence often comes by way of neglect. It's not true independence.
Mm-hmm.
But the wave that you just mentioned has a similar problem. They think they're better at relationships than they really are, because in some manner they had to take care of a parent when they were younger. They were rewarded for being clingy and dependent and young. And so these are two sides of a very similar coin.
And it's interesting because you mention in your audio program that most people are the anchor. They're sort of in the middle. That's what, about 53% of the population?
About that, give or take.
But then the next highest percentage are islands. And I feel like I'm probably kind of an anchor with quite more of a wave tendency. And especially when I'm in relationship with islands, which I tend to always be in. And that's when I get much more needy, because they're pulling away and I'm like, why are you abandoning me?
So it's just so people don't get too carried away. There are dyed-in-the-wool islands, and these are people who want to be in relationship, but they really have a hard time staying and maintaining closeness because they're always in fear of losing their freedom, their independence, their self. And waves, extreme waves, who are always afraid of being abandoned and sure, certain that as soon as they feel hopefulness, they're going to be withdrawn from, abandoned, punished, and so on. So they're very angry. But most people are wavish or islandish, and you can be in a relationship with someone who's acting more islandish, more wavish, and that can push you into one area or another like you're talking about.
In your book and your program, in the book, there's actually exercises that you can work on either individually or with your partner. And the audio program gets really in depth into, you talk about the amygdala and the hippocampus, and you don't get too technical, but just enough.
Not in that book, no.
Yeah, not enough for people to get the understanding. And it's really interesting how, I think we all know, we talk about this on the show all the time when we get into fight or flight. our resources are depleted. We can't think clearly. And that's where you're talking about being in this couple bubble where we're able to manage our partner. So we're able to see those cues of, okay, this person's starting to get escalated. What can I do to help calm them down so we don't have a blowout?
Right. You might think of two people having to balance themselves on a board somewhere in the mid-ocean area. And, you know, if their survival really depends on paying attention to each other, keep your eye, or, you know, take your eye off the ball and you both, you know, flip over and drown. So a couple system is very much like that. They're, you know, a regulatory system, a two-person system. Both people are responsible for keeping each other in an area where both can think. And when we get too aroused or too afraid, we stop thinking and we start to act in a very automatic way because we have automatic brains that really operate us 99% of the time during the day. So we're mostly an automatic brain. And this is very easy for us to get into a threat situation with our loved ones where we start to feel, you know, threatened, angry, trapped, attacked, and very easy to go to war with one another without even trying. So in this approach, we're really talking about science. This is, you know, we're using a lot of fun words like anchor and island and wave, but we're really talking about what we know about infant attachment, infant brain development, the way humans pair bond and have pair bond, pair bonded forever, how we really operate, and putting it to more folksy terms. So this is all science-based, research-based material that we're talking about here.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, this isn't just something you made up because it sounded good. You've done a tremendous amount of research, and so many other researchers and psychologists and doctors have been studying this for really decades.
Yes, and I'm good company. We a bunch of us relationship experts pretty much feel the same way about coupling and pair bonding, and I'll mention that later.
Okay, but now I do have one question regarding relationship experts. And this one topic is, it's a very hot button topic, and there seems to be two different camps.
Right.
And that's to do with pornography in relationship.
Ah.
Many dating and relationship experts say we should just accept that men look at porn on their own, privately, whereas a lot of women feel like it's almost akin to cheating.
Yeah.
So where, from a relationship standpoint, and just like efficacy in relationship, not a moral standpoint, what do
right.
you think of porn?
Well, it is a problem, and it's not, you know, it's not just porn, it's what porn represents, and that is a continuous flow of novelty, which was never available to us before the internet. And that's happening in a lot of different ways. Pornography is just one way it's happening. And by the way, before I get too far, there are plenty of women who are into pornography as well. It's not as talked about and certainly is not as rampant as it is with the male. But there are several problems with pornography on the internet. One is that it's an endless supply of novelty which stimulates the reward circuit in the brain. The very same reward circuit, by the way, that would be activated if we were making love to our partner or we were meeting somebody for the first time, it's the same reward circuit. So for people who are oriented towards, and these are mostly islands, people who are oriented towards self-stimulation and self-soothing, because that's how they were raised, to take care of themselves, they're more likely to get involved in something like this, which provides the brain with an endless supply of not only novelty, but the other thing the brain loves, and that's moving objects. And so if you look at what's available on the internet and why it is expanding into so many bizarre areas, it's because this is the way the brain works. We need more, and we need more novelty. We need more strange. The problem with it is that we're finding that there's a growing incidence of erectile dysfunction in young men because of this. And why would that happen? Because as long as people, especially those who are accustomed to taking care of themselves by themselves, the more somebody engages in pornography, the more threatening or dangerous, with a small d, their partner becomes. And so it actually becomes not just a desire for moving pictures and strange objects, but also it's a drifting away from the interpersonal, and that partner then becomes a little bit more threatening, a little more unnerving. And this is a problem that we're seeing. There's another problem, too. We can really talk a great deal. It is absolutely horrible with the young. We're seeing young girls and young boys looking at pornography and seeing this as an example of lovemaking, which it is not. It's that's kind of a little bit horrifying for people who have sons and daughters to imagine that they're getting their cues from porno. Mm-hmm. And how to treat each other, that's another problem, too.
Oh, I just had this image of something I've seen on the internet of how people are treated in those types of films, and
kids are looking at this and going, oh, I guess this is how you do it.
Wow, yeah, and I mean, it's degrading and cruel in a lot of ways.
It is, yeah. It's really a problem. It's society's problem, but this is, this is part of a bigger problem, and that is an ongoing ability to self-stimulate and self-soothe, not just with pornography, but just any number of things that are out there that's moving people away from eye-to-eye, skin-to-skin, and face-to-face contact.
Now, Dr. Stan, we've been taught from quite a young age now, and especially you mentioned children, in this day and age, we're taught that that's the norm. We're taught that we should just accept that, boys will be boys, men are going to look at pornography. And so how do you get your partner on board with this? I mean, really, there is a movement of men who are actually giving up pornography. And over the course of weeks and months, they're actually having much more satisfying sex in real life because they're not so overstimulated by this online representation. But I mean, that's, people are taught that it's normal. So how do you convince someone that maybe it would be better for them to give it up?
I think it's the same with everything else, drugs and alcohol, affairs, all other things that intrude on a relationship. Remember I said, we're talking about couple bubble, two people in a foxhole together protecting resources. Pornography and such is just another example of a third thing that can intrude on the resources of a couple. So that could be anything. It could be a mother-in-law, it could be a sister, an ex, a partner, whatever. So it really is very similar in this sense, that the happiness of two people generally is connected to the safety and security they create and maintain in their relationship. Something like this is going to hurt it. The problem is that many couples won't talk about it, and it becomes shame or shaming, and it goes underground. I think that this is a couple issue. It's not anything other than a couple issue. If your guy or girl is spending time with pornography, or you think, talk about it. I mean, but talk about it in a way that doesn't make them not want to talk about it. It's just another thing that people can do that takes away from the time spent with each other. Again, it could be food, it could be anything, but we don't want to make the pornography this big, precious thing when it can be any number of things that people bring in as a third thing or person into the relationship that destroys the safety and security of it. So I think it's really allowing it to be out in the open and not making it a moralistic issue.
Thank you.
As long as it's a moralistic issue, people are going to hide and they're not going to talk.
Thank you for clarifying that as well, Dr. Stan, that it's not just pornography. You're saying that's the distraction from the relationship. You call it a third, and that could
be
another person coming in. And we'll talk about that again after the break. It's time for a break right now. We are speaking with Dr. Stan Tatkin. You can find him at stantatkin.com. stantatkin.com. And Dr. Stan is the author of the book Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship. And also the audio program, Your Brain on Love. I highly recommend both. Even if you're single or if you're in a relationship, it's just such a good insight, not only into your partner, but into yourself and why you relate in the world the way you do. So we'll be back with more synchronicity in just a moment.
What are you doing Saturday, May 24th? If you're looking for one of the most fascinating, entertaining, and intellectually stimulating days of the year, come to the Vancouver campus for UBC's Alumni Weekend. General admission, including entry to all UBC gardens and museums, is free. CITR will be there too. For a full schedule of events, go to alumni.ubc.ca. Proudly sponsored by Cowell Auto Group and CITR.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we are speaking right now with Dr. Stan Tatkin. My girlfriend actually told me about his book, Wired for Love, and the audio program, Your Brain on Love, and I'm so excited that I had a chance to read it and listen. I feel like if I'd had this information a few years ago, it would have changed my relationships so much. So I am really grateful that I had the opportunity to invite Stan on the show, and thank you for accepting.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here. And you can call me Stan if you want.
Stan. All right. I like Dr. Stan, but okay, Stan.
Dr. Stan makes it sound like Dr. Phil, and I'd rather be either Stan or Dr. Tatkin.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Tatkin? Okay.
That's okay.
I appreciate that. All right. So now there's so many directions we could go with this, but what I'm really wanting to know, and one of the things that's not quite so clear in your book and in your program, is when do you bring this up with a partner? If you're in the dating phase of your relationship, when do you bring this stuff up?
Which stuff is that, by the way?
Just the agreement of having a partner bubble. And I mean, and there's so much to discuss, but not everyone believes in the partner bubble, especially islands. As well as waves.
I think this really speaks to right now I'm just now writing another book called Wired for Dating, which will be out next year. So I'm addressing this issue now. You know, this matter of dating and when is too soon and what are you looking for and who's the right person. I think this comes down to understanding what values or principles you want to have in a relationship that's a long-term relationship. And, you know, whether you're, you know, this is not so much about, again, attraction, but whether you're with somebody who's willing to play along with you and do the things that you believe are important, probably not the thing to talk about on a first date, but as you go along, I think the vetting process of a partner, are they someone who is likely to stick around and to want to work together as a team, again, the image of being in a foxhole together, or is this someone who may not be a good person to bet on, maybe has a bad track record, but also doesn't seem to have learned anything from the past. This is also where someone's social network comes in, and I think it's really important that that people eventually vet their new partners with their peeps, you know, male and female, and as many as possible, because it's really your social network that's also going to ferret out some of these folks that might be inappropriate. You know, you look good together, you seem happy together, is really an important thing to hear back. But I think this really rests in the individual's understanding of what is important in a long-term relationship, what is necessary, and does that person agree? If they don't agree, then that could be a problem.
And Dr. Tatkin, you mention deficits in your audio program, Your Brain on Love, and this is really important because we all have deficits in one area or another, specifically relating to theory of mind. I've found this a frustration because, and I know generally, in general terms, women tend to be more inclined to research relationships and whatnot. But, I mean, if I was dating someone with a very low theory of mind, I'm not going to probably be able to convince him to listen to your program.
Well, let me explain first what theory of mind is. Theory of mind, has to do with one's ability to be curious about one's own mind. I'm curious about my mind. It starts in childhood. And then that curiosity in my mind also translates into curiosity in your mind. So I think about myself. I can imagine what it would be like to be another person. I can put myself in your shoes. I would be able to write a diary about myself. People who lack a theory of mind, either because of a brain problem or because of poor development, because their parents didn't really have it, can't do those things. They have a hard time with it. And so that would be certainly something to rule out if you wanted to have someone down the line who could see you and understand you. People with poor theory of mind are fully, fully functional. They can be very successful in their work. It's in love that it causes a problem. Very nice people, by the way, can be. It has nothing to do with that, but it does have to do with insight and curiosity and imagination. So, yeah, that could be a showstopper right there if you find that that's a problem.
And Dr. Tatkin, also, I'm curious, because you mentioned a number of deficits. There's empathy. Some people have less empathy. For me, I'm huge empathy. I have, I guess, what you'd call thin boundaries.
Thin boundaries, okay.
I feel deeply. I'm deeply impacted.
Do you get what other people get? Do you have what's called affect contagion?
I do if I'm not really mindful of taking care of myself. It's something that I'm working on. I mean, some of these things you can learn and develop, and other things you may have a blockage in your brain. It really depends, right? And with regards to theory of mind or any of these deficits, I'm curious, is this a spectrum, or do you have it or you don't?
Well, it's not really known for sure. This is a hard thing to pin down. The reason we're even thinking or talking about deficits is not to put anybody down. It's the idea that, you know, our abilities to do certain things are not even in terms of brain power. We know this in terms of, you know, learning deficits. Or I'm not very good at math. My wife is terrific. And so I'll never be very good at math. But what about socially, emotionally? How good am I at reading a face? How good am I at responding to an internal feeling? Or do I even know it's there? How good am I at thinking quick and resolving an issue and calming someone down? These are skills and abilities that that can make the difference in a relationship when things get difficult. And so we're talking about from big to small, small being I'm not so good at reading emotions, to I can't read them at all. And there are people who can't read faces. There are people who have something called prosopagnosia, and they can't remember a face. There are people who can't read their internal sensations or feelings. So in other corners of their life, it doesn't really make a difference. But in love, it starts to make a big difference. In fact, love is probably the most resource-demanding thing we ever do, much more than work. And so if we have some of these so-called deficits, things that we're not that good at, they're going to come up there in the relationship, and they're going to be misinterpreted by our partners as being purposeful. You're doing that purposely. You know, you really could do that. You just don't want to do that. And sometimes we find there are people who actually can't. I mean, they don't get it. It's not they're not doing it purposely. They never could do this. But understandably, it's being misinterpreted.
And Dr. Stan, I've talked about the work of Alison Armstrong on this show before, and she talks about the difference between men and women, and some things are, in general, somewhat gender-specific, like men tend to be more of this way and women tend to be more this way. But this isn't, these deficits can come up in men or women.
They can come up men or women, but, you know, men, generally speaking, are not, and this is very general, are not as good as women because of the wiring in the brain, not as good at dealing with internal feelings and understanding them and being able to communicate with those feelings. It's not a strong suit generally of men. It is more of a strong suit with regard to women. And so there are some gender differences in terms of how we're built and how our wiring is. But then there are some things that are not really gender-specific, but we assume they are, like the island and the wave thing. There are plenty of island women out there, but we generally think of islands as being men, and that's not really true. So it's easy to get all this stuff confused. But yes, there are plenty of women out there who can have, and that would make sense, would have certain deficits that would disable them from being empathic or them to be able to see a certain emotion on a face or something like that.
And so, I mean, it sounds like part of it can be, you know, what you're born with, just the way your brain is wired, whether it's deficits or just the way you tend to be in the world. And a lot of it is how you were nurtured and your culture and how you were raised.
Exactly. Exactly. It's nature and nurture here.
And it's interesting. So there's we're talking about the islands and the waves and the anchor types, and that's your attachment type. But you talk a lot about a lot of different ways that we relate to one another, especially in relationships. And one of the things that you talk about is processing speed. And
Yeah. As
you can tell, I'm quite a quick processor. And when I'm with someone who's a slower processor, you did mention that the faster processors can tend to bully a little bit when you're in a disagreement, because I'm like, blah, 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 I want an answer, tell me. And he's like, and then you get more upset and it ends up in this big fight. So can we talk a little bit about the difference in processing speed?
We call them tortoises and hares, and I'm a hare like you. I'm very fast. Again, not a gender thing. There are people, and this has nothing to do with intelligence. This has to do just with processing speed in this area of social emotional functioning. There are people who can be very, very fast in other areas, but then they start to get in trouble in their relationships or have to talk about themselves in relation to their partner, and they slow down. So there's two reasons that people would slow down. One is because they're trying to stay out of trouble, either because they're afraid the next thing they say will get them into big danger, or they're lying. That's another reason why people will slow down. But the people who are always slow when talking about social emotional stuff are tortoises, and these people just process that information slower. And if they're with a hare, which often happens, that's kind of an unfair fight because the hare is just boxing them against the ropes all the time. So it's kind of an unfair fight. But it has nothing to do with lack of intelligence, and this issue has nothing to do with deception or lying or withholding. It's just a slower speed, that's all.
And there's some things like your attachment style, the ideal when you're in, if you're wanting a secure relationship, is that you, over time, you want to start having more anchor behaviors so that the two of you can become anchors. So that you're still going to have your natural tendency to be how you are, but you can start to change your behavior within the relationship to a way that's more effective. But processing speed, you've just got to accept that your guy or your girl is a tortoise. You can't speed that up, right?
No, you can't. Not really. Not really. I mean, you can try, but no, not really. And also the same thing with people who are high stimulation people and been that way from birth and come from very high stimulation families. They're going to be that way. Thrill seekers and rock and roll and loud and expansive, they're going to be that way. And there are other people who are very low and slow and not so excitable. They come from families like that. They're going to be that way too. So the problem here is not changing. The problem here is accepting yourself as you are and understanding yourself and taking responsibility for the things that you do that are not consistent with secure functioning relationship, and knowing your partner and accepting your partner as is, and knowing how to drive that car, ride that pony, you know, handle that person in the best way. That's really what we're looking at here. It's not that people have to change. It says they have to override their differences with an agreement or set of agreements that are based in secure functioning that protects both people. So that seems like maybe unclear. We know that there are systems out there that demand that you look out for your partner. Your life depends on your partner. No man left behind. You know, all of this business where the culture demands that you attend to each other and that you're loyal to each other, that you care for each other. We have that in the military and paramilitary cultures. These are people from all different backgrounds, yet they do it. And yet we have couples coming together complaining that they're so different and don't seem to be doing this. They don't seem to be in a couple bubble or in the foxhole together. And that's a matter of not getting it. People are not making agreements to do things that are good for both people to protect each other above and beyond personality, above and beyond momentary feeling, because to not do that, there are some pretty severe consequences. And I think people mostly are not understanding that. Does that make sense at all?
It does. I mean, I'm fully on board with this. I just wish I could get other people on board because I hear that so many times the whole, you know, the sense of I'm not ready for a relationship or you're not ready for a relationship. You're too much of a mess. You're too needy. Not necessarily about me, but just we have this judgment about people for having needs. Like, how dare you have needs? You should be able to take care of yourself.
We should be able to be as screwed up as we are and still be in a couple bubble, foxhole together in a relationship that's built on safety and security, no problem. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. There is no waiting. This is done in real time. And, you know, people out there can think of it this way. If we were in a war-torn area and bombs were dropping on us, would we be lamenting that we're not with our soulmate? No. We'd be pulling together and taking care of each other because we have to for survival. And we go back to our biology here. Why do mammals pair bond? It's partly to protect the offspring, but also to protect each other from the outside, from predators. We've lost this because we live in a very cushy world right now. But people who understand secure functioning get it eventually, hopefully not too late, and they begin to, make these decisions and agreements between each other and grow up.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, we could talk about this all day, but it's time for a break. So we'll be back with more synchronicity in a moment. Right now, we are speaking with Dr. Stan Tatkin. He is the author of Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship, as well as the audio program Your Brain on Love. And it sounds like he's working on a book, Wired for Dating, that's going to come out next year as well. So we will be back with more synchronicity in a moment.
The May issue of Discorder is here. This month's cover features local garage rocker Skinny Kids, plus articles on the ASL Singles Club, Fistful of Snacks, Kiss Painting, Wild Kind, and so much more. We are also proud to announce Homegrown Labels, a new column dedicated to celebrating record labels in our own city. So pick up a copy of Discorder around town or check us out online at discorder.ca and listen to a curated playlist featuring the May issue's artists. And a special thanks to this issue's advertisers, AEG Live, LiveVan.com, Moto the Car Co-op, North by Northeast Festival, the Rickshaw Theater, Sled Island Festival, UBC Alumni Weekend, and Vinyl Records.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is, without question, the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it, Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. are. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. And if you want more information on today's guest, Dr. Stan Tatkin, you can go to his website, stantatkin.com, stantatkin.com. Coming up in just a few minutes here on CITR is Parts Unknown. So stick around for that. Welcome back to the show, Stan.
Hi.
So one of the things that you mention, and I feel like this is kind of a relief, and we can sort of forgive ourselves and accept ourselves about this. You say that the need to be parented never goes away.
No, I think we think when we get partnered up, that our partner comes pre-trained, and that our parenting is done. And actually, it isn't. We train each other. We continue to parent each other in relationship. And that's an important function, I think, that that couples can and should perform for one another. And I'm not talking about, you know, doing this continually. I'm saying that we step in when necessary and do the thing that our parent or the other person's parent never did to help out, and do it willingly as part of the package. And so, no, parenting isn't done. It continues throughout life.
And what about, now, one of the agreements that you suggest, and it sounds like this is optional, is having 24/7 access to your partner.
Yeah. We have pithy statements like this that are intended to rile people up a little bit. In other words, things like, you know, is it okay for you guys, the two of you, to be available to each other 24/7? Now, people who are anchors, secure functioning, don't react badly to that question. They understand the spirit of it. But people who are insecure go, no, what do you mean? I don't want to be available 24/7. I don't want her to call me during work hours. Or I don't want him to wake me up at night. And they miss the spirit of this, which is, do the two of you give each other permission to be available at your beck and call? Nobody else can do that, just the two of you. And it works both ways. It provides a tether, that you're tethered to someone throughout the day and night, which is really something that should be done when you're a baby and in early childhood, but often isn't. It's a huge benefit, and it gives you a huge advantage over everybody else who doesn't have it. So why create that tether? Because when you are connected to another person, somebody who is also concerned about you as well, you have, one has more energy, more resources to do other things such as work, self-improvement, dealing with the kids or difficult people. When people are feeling insecure, they lose those resources and they become anxious and they're preoccupied. It's very hard to do extra things in life. It becomes harder because you're not feeling that there's a secure base there for you every day, at night, in the morning, during the day, and so on. So this is really a question of, would you like that? Would that be important to you? Would that enhance both of your lives? Of course, islands are going to say no. and waves will say, yes, of course, and will appear as if they want to take advantage of 24/7, literally, and nobody really does. The only people who get very, very clingy are the people who are with somebody who somehow sends a signal that that they're not available in some way.
Now, you mentioned, Dr. Tatkin, the difference. You mentioned the spirit of it. Now, I had that agreement with one partner, and the thing is that I have problems sleeping. And when I wake up, that's it. Like, my day, I'm wrecked. And so my agreement was, if you really need me, you can call me anytime. But if this is something that you just want to complain, like, please consider that I will be wrecked for at least 1 to 2 days. So consider that before you call me. And this partner would pick up the phone and just call me. and wake me up. And it was upsetting because, yeah, I feel like it was being taken advantage of. So how do you negotiate around that? Because I don't want to say you can call me anytime and then be upset because it's not, in my mind, significant enough. Because also, I don't know how that is for him. I mean, it may be insignificant to me. It might not be to him. So how do you manage that?
Well, because there should be also another principle, and that is do you guys take care of each other's distress? You know, am I in service to you when you're in distress, and do I minister to you? So, you know, one rule violates the other. If I do whatever I want, say whatever I want, call you whenever I want, despite the fact that it's distressing to you, then I'm violating another area here, another principle, that I care only about me and I don't care about you. So, you know, this gets complicated because agreements really are complicated. People actually have to mind themselves based on agreements that are good for both of us. So do I want to be putting you out many times, creating stress in you? How is that going to blow back on me? It's going to, because I am putting myself before the relationship. So that's a different discussion, you know. Somebody who's abusing that and is disregarding the fact that this is not important and it's keeping you up and making your day is really somebody who's putting themselves first or some other issue before the relationship, and that's where you take it up.
Okay, great. Thank you. And it sounds like, because I know that if we were in bed together and he had a bad dream, he might wake me up. And it's okay to, like, I could say, okay, like, come here and I'll cuddle you. I could give him that and still go back to sleep, but he would want to like hash it out. And I wasn't able to do that without fully being awake. And then I'm up for the day.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like a wave to me.
Yeah.
So much for your island theory. This sounds very wave-ish, that
yeah.
kind of behavior. you know, from what you're describing here. So sounds like you had a wave there.
Okay, good to know. All right, well, I also wanted to ask...
Waves, by the way, have a hard time at night often because nighttime is a time of separation, and it's the separation that causes anxiety. And so there's often a feature where people at the end of the day or the night, they'll want to turn around and start talking and engaging because the separation is too painful.
Mm-hmm. And I recognize that within myself sometimes too. And you mentioned in the book and in the audio program how waves sometimes will start this, like, want to have this deep conversation at, you know, 10 o'clock at night. And it's a way, or they'll pick a fight because it's their way of trying to connect, but they're not able to vocalize that.
Right. And if you understand how that person works, there's probably a way to help them and to help yourself, as they have to do for you as well, right? It has to go both ways.
Exactly. And now I want to touch on something you actually briefly mentioned, that this is possible. It's possible to have a secure functioning relationship within a platonic friendship.
Yes.
Now, with regards to the couple bubble and putting, you want to put your romantic partner, assuming you have this agreement with them, that the relationship comes first. So what if you have this friendship and then one of you gets into a relationship? How does that agreement work and change?
Well, but can you give me an example? What do you mean a friendship and one of you gets into a relationship?
Okay, so I actually have this in my life. My very best friend in the whole world, we've been friends for like 10 years, and we are, I wouldn't say we're completely effective with this secure functioning, but we have each other's back. We're like family.
Right.
When I had a new boyfriend, I let my boyfriend know that, you know, my friend was feeling a bit insecure and I was going to have to give him a little bit more attention. But when he went off and had a new girlfriend, it created a whole bunch of problems with the girlfriend. I still haven't met her after, it's been a couple of years now. And so anyway, like it's sort of like this battle between the best friend and the new partner. So how do you navigate that without, tipping over the cart?
Well, I think this really speaks to, the primacy of attachment relationships and how dyadic we really are. So you and I are good friends, good buddies, and we're best of friends. We're creating a you know, a primary attachment relationship between the two of us, and then one of us finds another partner that is romantic, it's going to be the same as if you and I were romantically involved. And the reason it's the same is because there isn't room in a dyadic relationship for threes, and that other person is a threat. And unfortunately, you know, there is some breaking of bonds when one relationship is now having to lower itself in value to the new one, which is the romantic relationship. So here, this can happen in families. It can happen with siblings. You know, I'm mad at you because you're leaving and you're getting married. We were so close. This is sort of the nature of our condition of our you know, relationships, that we feel this loss really very deeply, and it's not always easy to just say, oh, sure, go ahead, you know, just, you know, be happy with this new person. There's envy and jealousy and anger about being, you know, having something ripped apart. And as long as that's understood and not dismissed, I think then people can act in an empathic way toward each other. But this, I think, is just normal. You hear about it all the time. You know, twosomes become very important and, you know, very exclusive, as I think we're wired to have them. The idea that you should include a lot of other people and not be bothered by that is actually not normal. We're not that way. You know, we don't do polyamory very well as a species. We don't do thirds very well as a species. We're very dyadic in that sense. So it is a problem, but ultimately, if the romantic couple, which is the new one, is doing it right, then they're managing everybody else properly, hopefully not cutting people off, but not also letting them intrude on the couple system.
Yeah, so just to clarify, you're not saying a couple bubble means you guys have no friends or no life outside of each other.
No. The couple is the new system that is a leader, basically, for everyone around. It's a big mistake for people to burn their bridges and to cut off from people. The couple is a unit that includes everybody but does not allow other people to ruin their relationship, is what I'm saying.
Wonderful. Now, coming up in just a few minutes here on CITR is Parts Unknown, but Chris Horrific is not in, so I'm going to be playing a repeat. We do have time if you are able to go a few minutes over, but I want to be mindful of your time, Dr. Tekin.
Sure.
Okay, great. So I'd like to ask then, just to sort of clarify, you're talking about a mutuality type relationship. Now, what's the difference between that and codependence?
Well, codependence really speaks to a model that comes out of Alcoholics Anonymous, the alcoholic and the co-alcoholic. The co-alcoholic then morphed into what we call the codependent. That person is basically in a relationship that is lopsided, where he or she feels that it's unfair. There's some unfairness and injustice in the relationship. It's unbalanced, and yet they stay. And so you are, I feel that you're not there for me. You don't really pay much attention to me. I am feeling gypped and ripped off, but I don't break it off with you. I just complain. And also, I don't really know how to correct it with you. I don't say to you, look, in order for us to really do this, I have to do this, you have to do this, we do this for each other, we mutually benefit. So a codependent, or often their waves really, has a hard time doing that, because what is revealed in the codependent or the wave is, I fear more about abandonment than not really getting what I want. And so I sacrifice what I want and I just complain. Now, if I really believed in something like secure functioning, where this is a truly mutual relationship, we do things for each other that we agree on, this is what we do, this is what we don't do, and if we don't do that, or if you don't do that, then sayonara, I fire you and find somebody who will. I'd have to really live up to that above and beyond my fear of abandonment or being alone. And codependents typically lack that kind of principled stance. They fear too much about being left and being alone, and so they stay and feel very used and abused.
Okay, that makes sense. So the codependent would rather be, it's probably not an actively conscious choice, but rather be miserable than alone.
Rather be miserable than alone, which is not very attractive when you think about it, that you're just with me because you're afraid to be alone. I'm not going to feel very good about that. So, we want to be with each other because we can, not because we're afraid of being alone. You know what I'm saying? So we're doing this because we actually serve something. We serve something, that is the relationship, and we both put money into that kitty, and we both have to invest in this thing. If one of us doesn't, then it's not really equitable. It's not really mutual.
And with regards to that, and this is especially true of waves, we have to be really careful about threatening the relationship. Waves tend to like to break up and get back together, and they sort of thrive on that back and forth drama, but it really damages relationships.
Well, for anybody who is threatening implicitly or explicitly the relationship itself, there's a big danger there. Now, if you've just been dating for a year, then you don't know whether you want to be with this person. That's quite appropriate. But if you've been with somebody for 2 or 3 years and you're still holding out, you're still saying, I don't know, if only she would change this or he would do that, that's going to create a lot of problems, because when we feel somehow that the relationship may not exist tomorrow, we begin to act very weird. We're always in auditioning mode, and we're never going to be as good as the other person wants because we're too anxious. And so the threat to the relationship becomes a problem, and people become symptomatic. We know this from infants and children who are feeling insecure. They can't concentrate. They're angrier. They're not as able to focus. They're accident prone. Nothing goes well. The same with adults. If you're feeling insecure in your relationship, the chances of you not being as nice, not being as mindful, not being as attentive, as good in anything, it goes much higher if you're feeling insecure in a relationship. So do not threaten your relationship unless you have something you're actually going to throw down for, such as you either quit drinking or I'm gone. Now, that's a viable, reasonable thing. But you better be willing, if you're going to do that, you better be willing to say it and do it and actually throw down and leave. But if it is just a threat, it's going to cause lots of trouble for both of you.
Thank you for clarifying that. And also, you mentioned that this is more in permanent relationships, but I've noticed, because I've been doing a lot of dating, and one of the things I asked an ex, sort of one of the main things that he noticed that I could work on, and he said, I have a habit of saying, oh, I don't think this is going to work out early on, as when I'm noticing things that, I mean, it may be true. And in that situation, it was. We just weren't a match. But every time I vocalize that, I'm putting doubt in his mind as well. Whereas I could have just sort of kept that to myself, observed, and see like how it plays out, rather than speaking up every single time I have a worry.
Yeah, if you do that, what happens is it scares him, and then his behavior will scare you. This is kind of like a mutual, like, boo, you know. It rocks your world, and it changes the behavior in the other person for the bad. So just know, I mean, just imagine what it feels like to have somebody say, I don't think this is going to work out, or I don't know about you, or I don't know if I like you. Okay, it may be true, but it's going to really affect the way you feel and think, and probably not for the better. I prefer that people keep it to themselves, and then if you're going to leave, just leave. Don't threaten. The threatening just makes the other person act worse and puts too much fear into the mix.
And what I've noticed too, and this is what I've learned this through Alison Armstrong, is that if I can just sort of pause and think about, okay, what is it that I need, and then I can make a request around that behavior, and then I can observe whether it's changeable or not. rather than just complaining about it.
Yeah, I think, well, here's the other thing, and that is, these are all lovely questions, by the way. They're wonderful questions. They just have so much, there's so much depth, possible depth in the response to them. People really sometimes don't understand how to work together and create win-win situations. So part of, what we want to get to is to be able to create win-win situations for each other. And many times, those of us who came from families where we're certain we're not going to get what we want, and we, it's always going to be win-lose, and we'll be on the losing end of that stick, we give up too soon, we don't think in creative ways, or we may signal a threat to our partner without realizing it and start a fight. So a lot of this comes from thinking that we're with somebody who should know, or they're able to think like us, feel like us, and they're not. When you meet somebody, you meet them, and especially if you continue being with them, because you find them familiar in some way. We only pair bond with those we feel familiar with, but it's still a separate brain. And you're dealing with another person. I think respecting that and understanding that, and also understanding just how poor communication is across the board under ordinary circumstances. When people are unhappy with each other, that gets even worse. But we're not very good at communicating. The people are learn how to negotiate, how to bargain, how to seduce, how to influence their partner without using fear, threat, or guilt. This is a skill that goes very far in all areas of life, but it really must start in the couple relationship, that people start to think that way and they start to work that way without assuming that the other person should do this or wants to do this or understands it. I think we have to start there. The skill of creating a win-win, I want you to get what you want, I want to get what I want, how are we going to do this, let's do it. And people really have a hard time with this.
Thank you, Dr. Tekin. Well, do you have time to talk about the importance of the greeting and leaving, the morning and evening rituals?
Sure. Again, if we were living in a tribal area, we would probably be spending more time together, or at least there'd be more people around us. We wouldn't be so alone and isolated. But in many cultures, there are rituals around reunions and separations, and yet in our culture, we just really pay no mind to it. We are affected by reunions, and we are affected by separations. And those of us who are not, respecting that will pay a price. So bedtime rituals, going to bed, like I said, is a time of separation. It's important that people put each other to bed at night just as it was when we were children, that they wake up together in the morning just as it was as we were children, and that when we've separated, that we reunite properly, and not just, assume that the other person is okay or we're okay after being away at school or at the office, whatever. When you come home, you do a proper embrace, look in each other's eyes, even for a few moments, and then go about your business. Lots of fights, lots of problems are solved when people actually reunite properly, just spend even a minute to do this. And again, it has to do with our nervous systems, our perceptions about separations, and it's time well spent to solve and to prevent a lot of trouble, to just reunite properly. In the eyes, look in the eyes, embrace, some kind of skin-to-skin or eye-to-eye contact sustained for just even a minute or two, and then go about your business. Yeah. it does affect us, and I think this comes from a not understanding of how important human relationships really are to us. In our fast-moving culture, where and especially a culture that prides itself on independence and autonomy, there is a price that we pay here. And again, it doesn't take very much to do a proper goodbye, and even more importantly, a proper hello. And I think in other parts of the world they do this and they understand it quite well. I think that understanding needs to come here a bit. That our day does not go as well when the people most important to us leave without saying goodbye, come in without, an embrace. We're just not as good. And if people want to try this for themselves, all they have to do is be aware of it and see what it's like. Do your own science experiment, what it's like during separations. A lot of people are just not aware that they're feeling low after they separate, especially if they don't separate properly. But you feel low anyway. Maybe you feel anxious on reunion. Maybe you get angry on one gets angry on your reunion. Maybe one just wants to hide, not reunite. All of these are still reactions to a human need to reconnect after disconnecting. So people can try their own little science experiment and see how it feels. You already did, and you know it doesn't feel very good.
No, I notice I'm going to be much more mindful in with friends, too. I have a really close friend from broadcasting school, and they actually, it's funny because I used to always walk away and say goodbye, and they told me one day, they're like, Marie, I don't know if you know this, but in our family, we have this thing where as we're walking away, we keep looking back periodically and wave until we're out of sight.
That's funny.
And so now I do that with them. But I mean, it felt so weird to me. But now that I do it with them, it is that way of that separation ritual. And you do feel like you're cared for as they're still standing there watching you go.
Well, you're looking back and you're still aware that the other exists.
Yeah.
And you're being told that you exist when you do that. So this is, again, a little touch, a little thing that has to do, I think, with being held in mind. We want to be held in mind by our important people. We don't want to just be dropped.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really special, and it definitely makes a difference in how you feel when you walk away if you pay attention.
Yeah. And keep in mind, for those people who are out there and have islands in their lives, don't be mad at them. They just don't get it. They don't understand. Get them to do it and tell them it's good for them, too. This is how it gets, into the system is through in a loving way, not an angry way. So a lot of people just don't know this. They're not accustomed to it. Nobody did it for them in their family. That's not how their family culture worked. They're just doing what they know. It's not purposeful. It's not being done to you. They're just doing it and not aware. So, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Tatkin, you have been so generous with your time. Thank you. I want to be mindful of your time, and I'm just wondering if there's anything that you'd really like to focus on that I haven't mentioned, or how would you like to close the show?
Well, people I mentioned about a couple experts, myself, my wife Tracy, people like Harville Hendricks has really started this movement called Relationships First, relationshipsfirst.org. It's a nonprofit worldwide movement, science-based, to change the course of relationships, the way we're kind of moving in the world, to make relationships be important. And so Harville Hendricks, his wife Helen Hunt, but also other famous people like Dan Siegel, Sue Johnson, Alanis Morissette, John Gottman. A lot of us are all together here on this board. We're founders of this nonprofit called RelationshipsFirst.org. If people are interested, go to the site and say, I'm in, and you'll be part of this movement.
Awesome. And Dr. Tatkin, where is the best place for people to purchase your book, Wired for Love, or your audio program, Your Brain on Love?
Well, I think the books are available everywhere, Amazon, bookstores, And Your Brain on Love is a 6-CD set. You can download it from our site if you're wanting CEUs. We can provide that for you, or through audible.com, or through soundstrue.com. You can also buy the CD set on Amazon, but if you're like me, I like downloading stuff.
Yeah, I have it on my iPod. It's really helpful.
Yeah, it's easier. I like it.
Cool. And is there anything else you'd like to add before we say goodbye?
No, Marie. This was really delightful. I'm so curious. May I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
How old are you?
35.
You're 35. Okay. Well, I really hope you find somebody that's wonderful to you. You sound so delightful.
Aw, thank you. That makes me really feel happy. Thank you.
I'd like to see you very happy and in a good relationship.
Aw, thank you. Well, we'll definitely have to stay in touch. I'm going to have to read your book, Wired for Dating.
Yeah, I'm still on chapter one.
Okay. Well, I'll probably be bugging you. Are you done yet? Are you done yet?
I have a lot of people bugging me at the moment.
All right. Well, thank you again so much for your time, Dr. Tatkin. And it's www.stantatkin.com if you want more information on Dr. Tatkin. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Thanks. Take care. Have a wonderful day.
Bye.
So again, that was Dr. Stan Tatkin. He's the author of Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship, as well as his 6-CD set, Your Brain on Love. Both are fabulous. They have a little bit of overlap, but they are quite different. The book has exercises, and the 6-CD set goes into a lot more in-depth into all of these techniques and theories, as well as much, much more than we were able to cover, obviously, in an hour-long show. So again, thank you for your time, Dr. Tatkin. I'll be back with more Synchronicity Talk Radio for your body, mind, body, and soul next Monday. Please visit my website, spiritualshow.com, if you want more information about my show. Thank you so much for your time. I want to send you lots and lots of love. Up next here on CITR is Parts Unknown. Be well. Love you so much. Namaste.
Are you a band or musician located in Vancouver or the Lower Mainland? We're now accepting entries for Shindig 2008. All styles are welcome, whether you're a solo country artist or a 10-piece punk band.
You'll need to send us a minimum 3-song demo of original material, plus your contact information. Put everything in an envelope. Mail it or drop it off before August 8th to Shindig 2008, CITR Radio, number 233/6138, Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1, Canada.